for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday morning, Donald Trump tweeted that those who burn the American flag should have their citizenship revoked. We don't know if Trump meant this literally, but reporters spent the day explaining why that would be unconstitutional. It became the latest example of what many see as Trump's successful manipulation of the media. Here to examine how journalists are rethinking their approach under a Trump presidency, James Fallows of The Atlantic, Margaret Sullivan of The Washington Post, and Glenn Thrush of Politico. I'm sure many of you have your own thoughts. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks, Diane.
Thanks.
Jim Fallows, in your latest piece, you talk about a chronic and acute version of a public information problem in the U.S. Describe it for us.
Yes, by the chronic problem, I meant the fact that we've all discussed that over the last 20, 25 years, we have on the one hand the mainstream media suffering all the economic and cultural and other pressures we're aware of, and the traditional role of saying, okay, this is true, this is false, has been weakened. And we have the rise of these sort of information silos. The acute version is the person of Donald Trump. And the argument I make there is that what we have now see in retrospect as a sort of built-in constraint of most public figures, that they would at least try to tell the truth most of the time, and they would recognize it as a significant penalty if they are shown not telling the truth. This does not apply in the same way to Donald Trump, and therefore we need to sort of recalibrate our gears to say, how do we treat assertions where the speaker himself doesn't seem to care whether they can be proven false 5 minutes later? It just goes on and doesn't show any affect from that.
And the most recent example of that would be?
Oh, the most recent one. I guess there's a kind of unawareness in this flag-burning thing. That's not so much not telling a truth. I'll just give a simple example that I think illustrates many other things. There was a day during the campaign where Mr. Trump came out and just spoke directly in the camera saying, it's an outrage when the presidential debates are scheduled. The NFL has games those day. I've just received a letter from the National Football League saying they're unhappy about this. The NFL immediately said, there's no such letter. We never sent that to you. He then said, the Koch brothers are begging me to take contributions from them, but of course I'm not going to do that. The Koch brothers said, what are you talking about? We've done nothing of this. For most people, there'd be a kind of reflex. Think how Hillary Clinton was sort of skewered for her, I was under sniper fire on the tarmac story many years and years ago. We can remember that story because there is one of them. And there are other places where people complain about what Hillary Clinton has said. But I think the fact of somebody who is not constrained by the idea that if you can show it to be false 5 minutes later, it doesn't matter.
Margaret Sullivan, you're calling for a new journalism. What do you mean?
Well, I think Trump, as Jim has said, really changes the game, and journalists have to respond to that in a really strong way. They have to be willing to call out falsehoods and a kind of wackiness that, and recognize that a lot of people simply won't care. And yet they have to do that job better than ever. I think they also have to stop being as self-satisfied as they have been.
What do you mean?
Well, I think the journalists, particularly those of us who are coastal, we think we know a lot, and we think we know a lot about how politics works and how the electorate feels and how the country, you know, is going. And we've just experienced a big, you know, failure on that front. And for me, the correction is to put it bluntly, to get out more and to you know, not just to touch down in North Dakota and do a story and leave, but to dig in and to really understand how a whole part of the population is feeling and thinking.
And to you, Glenn Thrush, what is your take on all this? You're a political reporter. Explain how Trump has changed the rules of the game.
Well, I think Jim mentioned this before, or maybe it was Margaret, talking about the corkscrew landing in Bosnia that Hillary Clinton dissembled, shall we say, about. I broke that story, and I remember being outraged at the fact that she continued to repeat the falsehood for 3 months. I believe I broke that thing in November, and it was until February where she made that acknowledgement. And I thought that was absolutely wretched, and I was shocked that people weren't up in arms about that. We get two or three of those a day from Donald Trump. Look, I think there was a watershed moment earlier this year when the New York Times, on its front page, with reference to Donald Trump's birther smear against the president, used the word lie. I think we have first got to kind of get our terms straight as a business. How do we define these various terms? How do we identify lie? My thumbnail definition of lie is, if you know, if the evidence is out there, if the evidence is relatively clear cut, and you continue to repeat the falsehood over and over again for a motive, for a political or a commercial motive, or even a personal motive, you are telling a lie. The problem with that is, if you keep saying it over and over again, and we saw this effect with Trump, I think more in a more pronounced way, and this is really the most pernicious thing. If you keep saying that he lied, if you keep saying that he dissembled, if you keep fact-checking him, people get numb to this stuff. So we have to figure out a way, in addition to just call, in addition to our core function of calling him out, using the same tools that he uses to let his our articulation, our analysis of his falsehoods punch through with the same force. I don't know how we do that, but we've got to start thinking that way.
It's interesting, Margaret, because you've written that on the one hand, the New York Times took one a tweet that Trump had put out there and said, objectively, this is wrong. On the other hand, Glenn is saying you got to call it a lie.
Well, and one of the problems here is that, you know, we in the relatively the mainstream and often liberal media, we're talking to ourselves a lot. We're preaching to the choir. I think a lot of Trump's most fervent supporters, you know, knew very well that he wasn't telling the truth every minute. And they knew very well that he had done some things they didn't admire. But there was a larger question for them, which was that they had a visceral dislike and distaste for Hillary Clinton. They felt she'd been shoved down their throats. And this was a protest vote in many ways. And it overcame what many people considered to be pretty small potatoes. So what if he doesn't tell the truth? Politicians never do. That seemed to be the thinking.
James.
So I had forgotten that Glenn did that great story. Forgive me for having that brain melt. But that was significant because it was a flat-out lie that you pursued and that was told with her. I think there's what Margaret is saying, there is a phase shift we should be aware of now. There were all those dynamics you mentioned during the campaign, the reasons people liked or didn't like Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. But he is now apparently going to be the president. And the question is the premises we bring to bear in our coverage. And essentially, I'm saying that in contrast to all political coverage in my lifetime, even Richard Nixon, I think the starting point for most press coverage is that there's no presumption that anything Donald Trump says is true. And we should start from the premise that this might be true, it might not, and then pursue it, but not present it as the president says X, critics say Y, because the president may be just making up something as X just because of something in his nature.
But how do you do that? How do you report on a tweet that he puts out there that you know and you know and you know is totally false without somehow providing some balance, Margaret?
Well, for one thing, I would like to see a little less reporting on tweets. I understand that what the president-elect says in any medium, whether it's Twitter or some other way, is important. I totally get that, and I don't think we can ignore what he says. But I think when he goes after the audience at Hamilton because of the way they booed or reacted to Mike Pence, that can be a ridiculous distraction. And I think we need to have a little bit more order about what's important here and what isn't. So, I feel strongly about that.
Glenn.
I agree with Margaret on the larger point, but I disagree profoundly about the modalities that we need to use. We cannot denuclearize. This guy has, 25 million followers right now. It's an extremely powerful, direct way of getting to our audience or the audience at large. Think of that in comparison to a newspaper circulation or even a website circulation. A lot of websites are really happy to get 25 million unique users a month. Trump has an unparalleled direct access to the people that he wants to talk most to, and we got to recognize that. So I think pulling away from those media is a profound mistake. What we need to do is to figure out a way to deploy the weapons of truth as effectively as other people are deploying the weapons of dissembling. I'm a tabloid guy. I come out of the New York City tabloid environment. And by the way, so does Donald Trump. We have got to figure out ways to tell our truth more loudly.
Glenn Thrush, he's senior political correspondent for Politico. Short break. We'll be right back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're talking about how the news media needs to change its coverage, how it does its work, how it approaches Donald Trump in an age of tweets, many of which are false, a whole new approach, perhaps, to journalism. Joining us now is Scotty Nell Hughes. She is joining us from Nashville. She's political editor of RedAlerts.com and a contributor for CNN. Scotty Nell, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I gather you called Donald Trump the media's worst nightmare. Talk about why.
Well, it's simple. We know he ran a non-traditional campaign. It was a non-traditional election, and because, as we see, the polls did not accurately – well, the polls actually predicted, but nobody was expecting amongst the media the outcome that we got. And now we're going to have a non-traditional administration. And so the media – who's known for supposedly being flexible, is dealing with a situation they've never dealt with before. And it's not just because of who the candidate is. It's because of the environment that we live in. No other president has been able to directly talk to the people and have the tools to do that at his fingertips, like Mr. Trump is, whether we're talking Twitter or YouTube or Facebook Live. Social media has opened up a new channel that goes directly from the politician to the people. And Mr. Trump knows that. He recognizes that. And the media is going to have to figure out how they're able to still be able to get a message out that in many ways Mr. Trump feels like he can accurately do better just going directly to them.
Now, I know you've been listening since the top of the program, and I'm sure you've heard James Fallows talk about lies that Donald Trump has put out there in tweets, in things he said. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's also an idea of an opinion. And that's, on one hand, I hear half the media saying that these are lies. But on the other half, there are many people that go, no, it's true. And so one thing that has been interesting this entire campaign season to watch is that people that say facts are facts, they're not really facts. Everybody has a way. It's kind of like looking at ratings or looking at a glass of half full water. Everybody has a way of interpreting them to be the truth or not truth. There's no such thing, unfortunately, more of facts. And so Mr. Trump's tweet amongst a certain crowd, a large part of the population, are truth. When he says that millions of people illegally voted, he has some facts amongst him and his supporters, and people believe they have facts to back that up. Those that do not like Mr. Trump, they say that those are lies, and there's no facts to back it up.
All right, let's go to Glenn Thrush and let him comment.
First, I got to pick my jaw up off the floor here. There are no objective facts. I mean, that is an absolutely outrageous assertion. Of course there are facts. There is no widespread proof that 3 million people voted illegally. It's been checked over and over again. We had a Pew study that took place over 15 years that showed people had more likelihood of being struck by lightning than voting illegally in an election. Facts are facts. I'm sorry you don't like the facts, but you know, you said a couple of things here that I think are people really have to understand. First of all, your president, our president, Donald Trump, president-elect, is not the first president to go around the mainstream media and get to people. What were the fireside chats? What was the early advertising? The earliest ages of our days of our republic, media was entirely partisan. So you got to understand the historical precedent. Trump is just using the newest tools at his disposal. And you are the one thing I think you got totally right. That PolitiFact would give you a completely true score on is we definitely need to start responding to this.
And James Fowles.
So I think.
Okay, hold on 1 second. Let me respond back
sure.
to Glenn Thrush.
Go ahead.
Now that I know that Glenn is listening, actually, what you said was wrong. Let's look at it. 2014 electoral studies. The journal showed that in 2008 and 2010, illegal immigrants were higher. And this was done by four. These illegals were actually voting in it.
Can you give me the number, just at Old Dominion?
As many as 2.8 million. That these four professors at Old Dominion and George Mason came out and proved and said 2.8. Pew Research poll, that same poll you cited, actually 53% of Democrats at the Democratic Party support letting illegals vote. These are people that actually monitor those polls. So this is why, if anything, we should have stronger voter ID laws in all of these states to make sure that we don't have this type of conversation going forward.
All right.
Because in many states, you can mail things in. Those work. So, yes, there is facts to back up what I said and why Trump supporters believe it. You are wrong, sir.
It's often the more specific, quote, smaller issues where the fact issue is more dramatic. Donald Trump has said there were 20,000 people outside a certain hall. The fire marshal said the hall holds 3,000 people. He said it one day, the NFL asked me to move the dates of these debates. The NFL said, what are you talking about? We've never contacted you. He said he gave donations to these various charities. David Farrington of The Post contacted hundreds of these charities, said they'd never had received it. So there are matters of opinion. I think that it was very revealing, an important thing that Sky Nell Hughes was saying, which is that there are no facts. I think it actually is an intended result of this campaign and administration to think, well, really, there aren't any facts. It's all opinion, so we're going to sort of manipulate the things that we care about. I believe that the job for the media and civil society now is essentially to say there are such things as facts. So the line may be drawn here.
Scott.
Yes. Well, what's interesting, what he just said, all those people he mentioned are known biased, including political.
The NFL? NFL is biased?
That's the question that you have to ask right now. These were private conversations that happened with the NFL. The NFL that came out and spoke about it, the person who did, was someone that we've proven has not been necessarily a Trump fan. We don't know the conversations that happened. And just like it was reported that the Secret Service, the media report, the Secret Service came and talked to Mr. Trump about his comments regarding Hillary Clinton. That never happened. But yet the media doesn't say, we're sorry we made up that lie about you, Mr. Trump. That's the problem with this, is we've somehow gone as journalists from stopping reporting the who, what, where, the facts, and we've mixed in our own opinions of why. And there's, you know, there are some that still do that. But unfortunately, people like Fahrenthold, who you actually pointed out, they feel like interjecting their own opinion into it. So any facts that they might be able to report, nobody believes because he's interlaced his opinion
all
in
right.
other places.
Okay. And Margaret Sullivan, you'd like to say something.
Yes. Scotty, now, with due respect, if you identify as a journalist, you cannot also be saying there are no facts, which you did just say. And I also just want to challenge your language in describing people who are immigrants who are not documented. I think it is offensive to call them illegals.
But that's what they are. That's part of the whole problem here. That is a fact. If you are here illegally in this country,
illegal is not a noun. Illegal is not a noun.
You are illegally here. That's why Mr. Trump won. If you want to keep going down this path and using this politically correct, basically non-factual language of calling them undocumented immigrants and not calling them what they are, all you're going to continue to lose. The Democratic Party is going to continue to lose. And the facts, there are such things as facts. But facts, however, the media has taken them and skewed them so much that it depends on, you can look at reports from people like Daily Caller, Breitbart, Washington Times, even things, you know, that don't necessarily go along with your opinion, and you will say those are not facts. Well, guess what? It's a two-sided mirror there because they say the same about your reporting.
All right, Dan. No, on that very note, I want to ask you, Scotty Nell, what you believe journalists should be doing in covering Donald Trump.
Well, and let me say this. I'm a classically studied journalist, but I will be the first to say at this stage of my life, I am an opinion journalist. So when I say something, I'm going to go on and put that disclaimer. I'm giving you my opinion in it. The problem is journalists today going forward are going to have to start saying, I'm giving you an opinion or I am giving you just the straight facts. I'm leaving the why out of it, my explanation out of it, if we're going to restore credibility into this field. What journalists need to do going forward with Mr. Trump is they're going to have to actually start being straight with him. If you're an opinion person like Sean Hannity, he's going to, and I think we all pretty much know, he's going to have whatever he says based with his own opinion. Now, others need to be as honest about that. And so going forward, journalists are going to have to realize that when they're being basically played with right now like cat and mouse, and the cat is winning. When they put out a press release detailing every single item that the three of them had for dinner last night, including their dessert for chocolate cake, you realize that you are getting played and being made to look foolish. And those that take that bait are going to continue to be down this path of making an uproar over every little issue. Pick and choose what is important, what you actually think the American people need to know. And don't go off on all of these side tangents and actually talk with, you know, leave out the drama and stick with exactly the things that the American people
need. All right,
need.
Glenn Thrush.
I was not classically trained as a journalist. Mine was more jazz improvisation. I covered the New York City Council, and that's where I learned that most everything To paraphrase the great H.L. Mencken, the one way to look at politicians as a reporter is down. And that one has to, and we're not just talking about Donald Trump here. You have to, I've covered Hillary Clinton for the better part of 15 years, and I can tell you I've done a fair amount of substantial fact-checking on her as well. But your guy, and I will say this with complete objectivity, I covered Rudy Giuliani, I've covered a mass of politicians. Your guy dissembles, lies, makes stuff up at a frequency that no one has ever seen before. I mean, I think if you're going to talk about bias, this thing that you are calling bias, this is where you are blurring the line incredibly dangerously. It is not biased to call out problems with fact and interpretation. That does not make us biased. I don't think you ever heard, for instance, us using the term lie as frequently as we had with Mitt Romney, George W. Bush. And, you know, we even had I remember there being great debates during the Gulf War about the assertions that were made about weapons of mass destruction. I think your candidate has an estranged relationship with fact. And I think one of the really interesting things that I'd like to see to push this forward, because this isn't about beating him up or calling him a liar. The presidency, and James knows this, the presidency is the most information restrictive environment on the planet. The good thing about the presidency is the filtering, and Dennis McDonough, the current chief of staff, uses this as his personal job, is to make sure the president gets the best information so he can make the best decisions. My concern, particularly hearing that President-elect Trump, and I'd be interested in hearing your opinion on this, has chosen not, except on two occasions, to get the intelligence briefings that presidents-elect get. How is he going to make proper decisions and tell people the truth when he is not opening himself up to these more curated streams of real information?
You know, that's an interesting thing you brought that up. And I agree. The first time that I heard that he had not done, he had not received more than two briefings, I am concerned about that. But I also had some faith that Governor Pence had been getting them daily. I think Mr. Trump is approaching his administration different from any other before. That he's looking at as a team. When he picked his vice president, he is looking at, he picked somebody that truly was going to be a version of an equal, that they were going to work as a team like this. That's something that we've not seen necessarily before when it came to other presidents like President Obama and Joe Biden, who I'm sure are great friends, but haven't necessarily always been seen working together. Same thing even with Bush and Quayle. That you've never really had that. I think what Mr. Trump is doing, because he's being so transparent, here's my advice to those also in the media. You also have to, don't be afraid to say something nice about what he's doing.
All right, just one second, Scotty. Now let me just remind our listeners, it is the Diane Rehm Show. All right, go ahead.
The thing that we're seeing right now, we're seeing more transparency in a transition process, believe it or not, than I think we even saw with President Obama. We're seeing who he's actually bringing in. We're seeing daily press briefings, daily press phone calls. We're knowing more about, and whether that's positive or negative, we know who he's talking to. It's live on every camera that we can get. How about you say, you know what, that's a good thing. Now you can say something positive about what he's doing in the transition that he's trying to make very, very open for the public.
Scotty Nell, I want to ask you one question, and that is about the tweet that came out regarding flag burning and putting people in jail, taking away their voting rights. Why would your candidate, why would the president-elect put out such a tweet that surely he must have known was unconstitutional?
Well, here's the thing about the outlawing the flag burning, and you're right. I think what it was, he was very upset at the videos he would see. And we've all been saying, I think most Americans do not agree with going out and burning your flag, because that flag represents more than just a piece of cloth. Threatening to vote, take away rights, that's not really even an option. But this is actually the same thing. This is what's interesting. You want to talk about why people think the media is biased? This is the same law, you know, the same thing Mr. Trump tweeted out yesterday was almost exactly along the lines of the same idea that Hillary Clinton put the ban for in 2005. But yet we never heard her bring that being brought up during the election. So Mr. Trump yesterday takes all this heat for it, but we never heard that during the campaign thing. Do you guys remember her trying to take away your freedom of speech in 2005? So that just shows kind of the double standard. But
okay.
I think he's very, very
frustrated. James wants
to
comment.
That one, there was a pro forma bill she was part of long ago that was written with acknowledgement of the Supreme Court rulings defending flag burning that Justice Scalia and others had been part of, not taking away citizenship, et cetera. So I think it was the intemperateness that was part of it. And if I could just touch a couple of bases while I have the microphone here, I'll do it quickly. Number one, we mentioned earlier the role of taking in intelligence briefings. As I always point out, I worked in the White House long ago for President Carter. What stays with me is how difficult this job is of making this endless succession of 51, 49 calls and being able to be calm and dispassionate and restraining your impulses. And I think that's why a lot of people have been concerned about the impulsiveness. Just one or two other quick points. Scotty Nell Hughes mentioned the fact, this is why you're losing, et cetera. It has to be remembered as part of the factual record of this election that somewhere near 2.5 million more people voted for Hillary Clinton and voted for Donald Trump. Now, he's legitimately the president given the Electoral College, but losing is there's a larger picture going on here, too. I do agree with Scotty Nell Hughes that we're all in the middle of making things up here, figuring out how we're going to deal with this. Because if the pose of the administration is what we're hearing, there are no facts, it's all biased, and we need to reconsider what we're doing.
James Fellows, he's national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. Scotty Nell Hughes of RedAlerts.com. She is a contributor for CNN. I want to thank you, Scotty Nell, for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. It's time to open the phones, welcome our listeners into the conversation. First to Patrick in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I think what you journalists need to do as a group, and you, first of all, you have to decide to do this together, but you have to assault Trump the way he assaulted you. And you do that with every day in every medium, on every website, every Facebook, every newspaper, print the list of Trump's lies every day. The little ones at the top, the big ones at the bottom, and tell the public every day how this man is lying to them.
James.
So during the campaign, I did something called the Trump Time Capsule series, where I record each day something he'd done that no national nominee had ever done before, something was at flat odds with the fact, et cetera.
And such as?
Oh, such as, I mentioned the NFL thing, but with his attack on the Khan family, I'm not going to accept the results of the election. The election was rigged. This is rigged, et cetera. And so I got to 152 in this series by election day. And I think that while this can't be the main thing the media do, I think recognizing this is something unusual, abnormal, not sort of both sides, critics complain, is an important part of our mission.
What do you think, Margaret?
Well, I absolutely agree that we need to call out lies. I don't like the idea that that journalists are going to assault Trump the way he has assaulted the media. I don't actually think that's our role. I think our role is to dig for facts. It's to tell the truth. It's to search out the facts. And we may have to do that in a different way. But I don't agree with the idea of a combined assault on Trump.
I agree with Margaret, and I disagree with the caller that we have to call out his lies. I think we do have to give presumption. Generally speaking, we have to call out individual falsehoods, but we have to give a presumption. My feeling is, particularly on cable television, we need a real-time chyron when someone is giving a speech, fact-checking points of fact. There are various points that can be in dispute, and I was a big fan, and I was sorry that the debate commission rejected the suggestion of having some fact-checking component interwoven into debates. I think that is essential going forward, and we got to have a bigger national discussion on this.
Okay.
And just to follow up with one or two illustrations, when Donald Trump said during a debate, you know, if I'm president, you know, you'd be in jail, that sort of thing, lock her up. Again, that's outside the norm of American politics. When there was an airplane that disappeared over the Mediterranean, and he instantly said, this is 100% terrorism, that's different from the way presidents need to deliberate. So finding some way to record these things that are different in our national experience in an ongoing way, I think, is important.
All right. Let's go to Steve in Orlando, Florida. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I can't hope to improve on the comments of your illustrious panelists. I just wanted to suggest that the job of journalists going forward needs to be recognizing and rejecting false equivalencies. In this era of science denial, it's important to recognize that anecdotal evidence is not the same thing as empirical evidence. And the most important one to me is that it's important to recognize that Fox News is not the equivalent of the organizations that your panelists work for. It essentially is and always has been the PR arm of the Republican Party.
Margaret.
Well, I think Steve makes a very good point, and I like that this idea of false equivalence has you know, made its way into the conversation because it's very important. Journalists have come a long way on this in a relatively short time, and they are less likely now to go with this sort of he said, she said journalism and leave it up to the reader or the listener to decide what's true. We must state established fact in a news story on a broadcast when we can. So I'm glad that you brought that up.
James.
Yes, two quick points. One is the illegal voting case allegation is the clearest recent illustration of this. There is no real-world evidence at all that millions of people voted illegally. And so presenting this as sort of an open question is one illustration. The other is, now that we're past the campaign, and it's not a matter of weighing Hillary Clinton's faults versus Donald Trump's faults, I think in a way that false equivalence reflex will be less, and people can concentrate more on his administration.
Go ahead.
I want to throw one fact at the voter fraud thing. I spent an hour and a half with Chris Kobach in his office. He is the Secretary of State of Kansas and really the intellectual godfather of the notion that there's massive voting fraud in the country. And I asked him, what is the data set that you're using? He's an enormously engaging guy, and he's quite possibly going to be President Trump's DHS secretary. It's in the realm of possibility. And he cited, and I may be getting this number wrong, he did a 13-year study in the state of Kansas and found 212 documented instances of voter fraud over the course of 13 years and several million ballots cast. And then I asked him to extrapolate that nationally, and he was speaking much more about a dozen here, a dozen there, swinging a too-close-to-call kind of race. So the man who is most equipped in terms of providing the president with that information categorically denies these larger numbers.
All right. And joining us now is Mark Baldwin. Pardon me, he's executive editor of the Rockford, Illinois Register Star and the Journal Standard of Freeport in Illinois. Mark, tell us a bit about the city and region that your paper covers, and did Donald Trump resonate there?
Well, thank you for having me. Rockford really is the western gateway to Chicago, and our city population is, you know, between 150 and 160,000. We're in a metro area of about 400,000. We are the industrial heartland. You know, you can think of us as a slightly smaller Toledo or a slightly larger Peoria, but this is the industrial heartland. And, you know, 50 years ago, we had some of the highest per capita incomes in the United States. Those were eroded over the decades by offshoring, automation, and the other broad economic trends. Now we're rebuilding for the 21st century, but you have a lot of people here who felt left behind. Rockford itself is a heavily Democratic city, and Hillary Clinton won the city of Rockford with 57% of the vote. However, the county voted 56% for Trump, and Trump narrowly won the county. Of course, across the state of Illinois, Clinton, we were never in play. But, you know, you do have people here for whom that message resonated very deeply.
All right, and actually, you say the way people are getting information now is like a form of censorship. What do you mean?
Well, we thought of censorship in terms of a prior restraint. The Pentagon Papers being the kind of the classic example of that. But today, you know, information saturation is rather than pre-publication restraint is really how a political actor can censor the news because by flooding additional media with an array of messages, you create an environment in which no one really knows what's true and what's not. I think Trump is simply the most savvy user of, or maybe the most evolved inhabitant of, this new information ecosystem.
So what then do you tell your reporters? How did they go about reporting the news?
Okay. Well, you know, let me flip that for just a second. Number one, we really focus on doing high-impact work now. And frankly, I tell them, don't swing at a pitch in the dirt. When you know, we're no different. All the forces that your guests have talked about today are in play here in Rockford to one extent or another. And so, you know, we are tweeted at and get all sorts of Facebook messages that have little to no relation to reality. And I tell them, don't swing at a pitch in the dirt. We're going to traffic in fact-based reporting and stuff that's going to really make a high impact on the community. But you know, what's happening in our organization and it you know, legacy news organizations around the country now is that community engagement is becoming a larger and larger part of our business strategy. And that means, you know, bringing together the community around fact-based reporting to talk about significant issues. And with the emphasis there being on fact-based, you know, we also do things like take the editorial board on the road and meet with neighborhood organizations, immerse ourselves in their lives, and with a special eye toward diversity. And not just diversity of race and ethnicity, but also intellectual diversity, so that we really find out what's on people's minds. Mm. Among other things, what that does, it makes our processes transparent. It gives us a chance to show these are our standards of verification. Okay, I can't speak for the local website or local TV, but these are our standards of verification. And most of all, what it does, it also acquaints us with the street level concerns and the values of our audience. And I'll also say this, and it's germane to some of the conversation I've been listening to. It also requires a degree of humility. You know, we go to a place where we're a bit vulnerable, but I think that's a good thing for a journalist to do.
Mark Baldwin, he's executive editor of the Rockford Register, Star, and the Journal Standard of Freeport in Illinois. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
James, you know, you've said that in a sense what we're doing here is fighting for reality itself.
There was a really interesting essay a day or two ago by Ned Resnikoff at the Think Progress site, and I'm sure on your website and mine at The Atlantic there'll be specific relations to it, talking about the deliberate political strategy that Steve Bannon and others have advocated over the years of trying to attack the idea of reality itself, of knowable fact, of anything that actually is true. If we go back 200 years plus to the documents of the founders, there was some idea that you'd have to have facts and reality and public knowledge and ways that people can engage. And so if we're in error, so I think that is what journalists and civic society now need to engage themselves for. None of us has the answers for that now. It's the beginning of the process of figuring out how to do it.
And how do you begin, Margaret?
Well, I just want to say that I've been hearing from, because I've been writing about this, I've been hearing from a lot of readers on all sides. And one of the things I do hear is the hunger and the very strong feeling that they want their mainstream media to do this job and to hold people accountable and to remind us of what is true. And, you know, the New York Times just reported that their subscriptions are way up. There is a groundswell, I think, of understanding that journalism is more important than ever right now.
The idea of a small newspaper getting out and talking with its readers, being out there involved with the community, seems to me very important for a newspaper. How does Politico do that, Glenn?
Well, first of all, I want to tender my job application to Mr. Baldwin, who sounds like he's really got something, got it going in exactly
absolutely
the right direction. I've spent a lot of time out in the country. I am, you know, that is the basis. All of our reporters mostly come from legacy publications. So, you know, we do get out there and do that. Granted, we do tend to cover it from the political frame, but we do need to do more of that.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go here to Arlington, Texas. Steve, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
One of the things I'd like to point out is that most journalists work for for-profit industries, and what goes on the air and out over the their waves is managed content by business people whose job it is to make money for the organization. So, I don't have the numbers, but I'm sure that advertising revenue skyrocketed during this past campaign. And so there was a business incentive to provide a sense of balance and equivalency in order to make more money. And so, journalists, they want to do what's right, but they work for people in organizations whose goal is to make money.
Change.
Yes, this is an eternal problem in public information journalism reaching a new acute stage. We know over the last 20 years or so, online media, Facebook, Google, Twitter, et cetera, have been sucking revenue from the established media. We know that during this campaign, whenever Donald Trump was on TV, more people watched than didn't. So CNN, for example, reported high revenue. So again, part of this reconsideration of how we understand our world is trying to think again about the economic base of this function of journalism, which has never been a self-supporting business. It's always attached itself to something else. We have to find out what the new host body is going to be to provide this essential function.
I'll give you the Les Moonves quote, which is really the big quote of the whole year for me. He said it, and he's the president and CEO of CBS. He said this in February. Quote, Donald Trump may not be good for America, but he's damn good for CBS.
As Edward R. Murrow used to say about Joe McCarthy, right? No, being sarcastic.
Margaret.
And this is one of the great paradoxes of Donald Trump, is that he benefited so immensely from the exposure on cable news networks, and then he turned on them. And he, I think that Jeff Zucker, the head of CNN, recognized, because he had worked with him and elevated him at NBC when he was there, the apprentice, celebrity apprentice, he saw that Trump was, in his own words, a ratings machine. And so he made the most of him at CNN, very much to the benefit of the bottom line, but I don't think to the benefit of the nation.
I've got a number of callers who are all saying what they want is just the facts, and then they'll decide. They don't want opinions from journalists. But if journalists are confronted with falsehoods, don't you have to weigh in, Margaret?
I don't think that the listeners really would want, let's say, the Washington Post to be filled with AP-style journalism that is nothing but the raw facts. I think there is a need to interpret, analyze, provide context. That doesn't mean that there needs to be opinion and bias. And I do understand that they're making a distinction, an important one there.
Very briefly.
Yes, I agree. And so it's a matter of providing a factual basis for the best version we can of understanding the world.
James Fallows of The Atlantic, Margaret Sullivan of The Washington Post, Glenn Thrush of Politico. What a wonderful discussion. Thank you. And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Baker, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Danielle Knight, Erica R. Hendry, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Douglas Bell.